Path Projects. Path Projects has got the finest running apparel anywhere. Just ask the experts. They know.
Or try it, and you'll find out very quickly that it's the finest apparel you'll ever wear. You know, the one thing that I like, Freeman,
what's that?
They're coming out with new stuff all the time, but they have a lot of different shirt colors now. They have the blue, they have the gray, they have the black, they have the white, all sorts of different colors.
I just know they feel great. Doesn't matter what color you're wearing, it just feels good. And they think about everything. They think about where the stitching is and how it relates to your arm movement. They think about the stretchiness in the material and where that material lays on the shorts or for your pocket.
You know, as we're talking to Ashley Walsh, or Ash Walsh, as we are finding out after 8 years, she likes to be called Ash. She was saying at this race, chafage is what took a lot of people out. Path Projects with that underliner, I think that would help a lot of those people that deal with chafing.
I ran some of those long multi-day races, Scott, and chafing wasn't an issue in my Path gear.
The only way you're going to find out whether this truly is the best running gear you ever had is just to try it. Go to our partners page, click on the Path Projects banner, and just try it.
Or come over to Scott or I's house. We'll loan you a pair. We'll go run around the our favorite path with you.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Come on over.
I've got multiple Path Projects gear in my drawer. I'll loan you some.
Pathprojects.com. Ragnar Trail Races. There's one for you.
They're everywhere, Scott. I mean, they're in the Appalachians. They're in Richmond. They're in Vermont. They're in the Great Midwest. They're in the South, the West Coast. They're everywhere. And in particular, they have one coming up in Tahoe, July 12th and 13th.
At Sugar Bowl Resort, and it's going to be a lot of fun. They have a lot of vertical, 2,000 feet of climbing in that race.
It's a legit trail race. And if you've ever been to Tahoe, you want to go back. And if you've never been, you need to go.
They're going to have at the village is where your team kind of resides when you're out doing your loop.
Yes.
They're going to have food trucks out there, great food trucks, gourmet food trucks.
And a lot of smack talked, I believe, about the other teams and maybe even the guy that's out there running.
And if you're concerned, you know what? I'm not a camper. I don't have a tent. You don't need to worry about it. You can sign up under their glamping option. You pay a little bit more money, and they take care of everything.
There'll be plenty of glamping out there, Scott, especially if it's warm and you're not having your electrolytes.
You can get $80 off a team registration with the code TRNATION. Go to our partners page, click on the Ragnar link, and use the code TRNATION.
Or go to runragnar.com and see the list of all of these great races. It's easy to explore. They have road races, sunset races, and trail races. Go check out their list. They are working hard out there.
Get your team together and have some fun this year.
Are we recording?
Dr. Romanoff, you're probably very experienced at professional interviews. This is not one of them.
Oh, come on. Don't put yourself down.
we are very casual. That's a good word.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
And it was a miserable, miserable day.
Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Scott Ward.
And I'm Don Freeman. And Scott, welcome back, because last week you sounded like Barry White, and it's nice to have you back.
I was faking an impression of Barry White last week.
And you did it well. You stayed in character, and we're lucky enough to have Andy Jones-Wilkins with us today, too. Welcome, Andy.
Hey, guys. Great to be back. It's awesome to be on Trail Runner Nation again.
And today we're doing a part two of a book called Training for the Uphill Athlete. As you recall, the previous one we had Scott Johnson on the phone or on the line, and we talked a little bit about the book. And today we have another co-author. There's three authors to this book. We have Steve House, who's joining us.
So welcome, Steve. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Real pleasure to be here on Trail Runner Nation.
And part two, because it's so good, Scott. This book is just so full of great information that we needed to take another run at it.
It's what I think 370 pages of juicy goodness.
And I think I said last time there are some books that are okay to get on Audible. This is not one of them.
No.
The pictures are unbelievable, and the graphs are just essential for instruction.
Right. I'm going to give a little bit of a background for Steve. And as always, Steve, you have editorial rights to tell me whether it's accurate or not.
Okay, let's go.
So
I like the parts that aren't.
As long as they're complimentary, right?
That's right.
So Steve, who's with us, he's been a professional mountain guide since 1992. And he guides trips all across the globe from Alaska to the other end of the globe.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, he's an accomplished. In addition to being an accomplished guide, he's also a world-class climber. Have you ever heard the name Andy Reinhold Messner?
Of course.
Okay.
Of course,
so,
yeah.
So Reinhold Messner, I didn't know. I've heard his name because I've read a lot of books about climbing. He's the first. He did the first solo ascent on Mount Everest, and he's the first. Did the first ascent of Everest without some supplemental oxygen. Let me tell you what Reinhold says about Steve. He says he's the best high-altitude climber in the world.
Hmm.
That's who we're talking to today, Freeman.
Tall compliment there.
So is all that true?
Well, I mean, Reinhold did say that quite some time ago. So, this day, I don't know if I would buy that, but yeah.
Okay. And the third author of this book is Killian Jornet, who is a well-known name with our community here. So now you have the three authors here.
So the good thing we edit part of this out, and we'll certainly have to. Hey, you put this book together. There, you can go onto Google and put in, training and uphill and athlete and get a various word search. There's a lot of books. What inspired you to come up with this book? Why did you write it?
Well, actually, I would trace that back to an Instagram post, of all things.
Wow.
Scott and I wrote a book called Training for the New Alpinism that was addressing training for the type of mountaineering that I specialize in, alpinism being kind of the in word these days for mountaineering. And Killian Jornet posted a picture of our book. And in the caption, he wrote, "Have been reading this book from Steve House and Scott Johnson. It's so informative and interesting. And I wish there was something like this for mountain running and ski mountain." And I didn't even follow Killian at the time. Of course, I knew who he was. So I got in touch with him a little bit. And we started to converse. And he turned out he and his partner, Emily, were going to be down here in Colorado in a couple months' time for basically a training camp. They're doing a bunch of ski touring in December of that year. And so they came out and I showed them around the local mountains and we started basically a friendship. That next summer, Killian and I got together in Switzerland. He needed a climber alpinist to help him with a parts of a technical ridge traverse he wanted to do that he's actually still trying to work on. And the weather was really bad, so we spent like 4 days just talking. And out of that, I got home from that trip and I called Scott and I was like, we got to do this book with Killian because he's right. There's nothing for the sports that Killian specializes in. And it's, the more I talk to Killian, the more I realize that it's kind of all the same because we're talking about these ultra long endurance events. In my world, it's maybe was going for, 24, 48, 62 hours nonstop of climbing. That's like a ultra run where you have aid stations, you're stopping to take a break, but you're never really camping or sleeping. Or on the other end, we do like all these, what would be the equivalent of stage type races or runs where we're maybe spending 7 to 10 days, but we are actually sleeping for, at least some significant amount every night. And Scott said to me, "Oh, that's great, but we don't have the credibility because, to the first book, I brought the credibility as the athlete. Scott brought the credibility as the coach, and we kind of had this synergy. But we didn't have that with the community we're talking to here today, specifically trail runners and also ski-mo racers, ski mountaineers. So we kind of were talking about this and said, well, maybe Killian would do it with us. And then when we talked to Killian, he was like, okay, yeah, I don't have a ton of time, but I really want to see this happen. So let's figure out how we can make this work. And that was, I don't know, 4 years ago now, 3 years of process later and a bunch of time for edit and design. And here we are.
You know, it's interesting to me that you bring, you know, mountain runners and ski mountaineers. What does the training, is there a difference in the training is the things that ski mountaineers do? What are they up against? We know what trail runners are up against in multi-day events, but maybe describe to us what happens, what kind of terrain and what kind of exertion levels are needed for to be a successful ski mountaineer?
Well, in the racing part of ski mountaineering, which is sometimes called SkiMo for short, or randonnée racing in France, it's very similar. And there's events ranging from vertical Ks, which, you know, are going to last 35-ish, 40 minutes for the top competitors, depending on, of course, it's on snow, to, you know, week-long stage races, where they're typically based in a town. But some of the, and there's also races that are essentially ultras, like there's a famous one called the Pyramide that starts in Zermatt and starts in Zermatt and ends in Verbier, which is, you know, takes the winning guys now, you know, not very long, but most people it takes them 24 hours ish. So a lot of, and the terrain's sort of the same, it's just covered in snow. What is different is, you know, the footfall is different. You're not, you know, you're generally not in a running, bounding kind of motion. You're in a striding motion, more akin to like a slow version of classic cross-country skiing. But, you know, the aerobic engine is the same. And what we see, and what Andy has probably seen in his forays here to the San Juan Mountains in Colorado, because it's super popular here, is a lot of people that are into mountain running are using skiing as a training modality for wintertime, because, you know, can't run in these mountains in the winter. Right now there's 12 feet of snow up there. So it's a real good corollary for that, those athletes. And it's just different enough too. I think there's a lot of advantages to giving certain parts of your body a little different attention, to different break, so to speak.
Hey, Steve, I wanted to share a little personal anecdote and then elaborate on this connection between the mountaineering and ultra running. I lived for 5 years, from 2006 to 2011 in Ketchum, Idaho, and I was lucky enough to be neighbors with Peter Whitaker of Whitaker Mountaineering and Mount Rainier and Ed Viesters. They of course are, you know, the Whitaker family. And of course, Ed has done a lot of stuff similar to you. And I remember as I stood in awe of what they were doing, they also were kind of watching me train for Western States and train for Hard Rock. And at the time, I mean, here's, you know, a guy who's, you know, done Everest without supplemental oxygen. And he looked and it was dumbfounded at the idea that I would run 100 miles at one go. And so it's interesting what you guys have done, because you've, with Killian's help, you've kind of brought those worlds together. What do you see in do you still see sort of mountaineers looking sideways at you guys and like, why are you trying to bring together long-term, long-range days in the mountains with sort of pure mountaineering? Or are you seeing the marriage happen naturally, and as a result of the marriage happening, kind of having this opportunity to bring the sports together? You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I think you see everything. But when I look at the pointy end of the spear of both of these sports, mountaineering, let's go, mountain running, let's say three sports, ski mountaineering, mountaineering, climbing, mountaineering, alpinism, whatever you want to call that. And mountain running, I mean, Killian is a great embodiment of that, right? Like climbing Everest in a day, basically, you know, and then going and winning races like the Hard Rock and winning the SkiMo races that he's won and when not winning, placing well and these kinds of things. That is the direction a lot of these sports are going for certain people. Not everyone has that interest. And I think, Killian, if you take him, here's a great example. The late, great Uli Steck was a Swiss climber who had the speed record for climbing the North Face of the Eiger. So He had his speed record was by himself, which was about 4 hours and 20 minutes for a climb that's about 6,000 vertical feet. His record for climbing that with a partner was about 7 hours. Okay, using a rope and having another person with him. Okay, he and Killian did it together, and their combined record was a little over 12 hours, almost double what Uli's record was with another climber. So you can see my point of that is not to denigrate Killian's skills at all. It's to say, you know, Killian's specialty is not technical climbing. He's this aerobic animal, right? But he has some, his father was a mountain guide. He knows the basics of climbing. So he was able to still climb the Eiger in 12 hours. Wasn't a world record time, but when you get somebody who's much better at climbing, who doesn't have the aerobic engine, they can still do the North Face of the Eiger in 7 hours. This makes sense. And these kinds of things are cropping up all the time these days, both on the sort of extreme technical end of the continuum of climbing, and also on the extreme aerobic side of kind of FKTs and this stuff, whether it's an organized event or not. And we're seeing a lot more of that just in mountaineering, whether it's an fastest known time type thing of Everest, which honestly people didn't, as mountaineers, we didn't really pay attention to that like 10 years ago. But now all of a sudden people are doing stuff like that.
Yeah, I just had a question on that. You mentioned FKTs, and that's, I kind of think that that's more of an acronym that we as trail runners use, or that through hikers use. It sounds like it's become a bigger part of your community also, is FKTs?
Yeah, I think we've certainly borrowed the term. We didn't make that up. We used to say speed record.
Mm-hmm.
But I think FKT has kind of become the universal, and you have that for, you know, like in Yosemite, there's a bunch of FKTs for climbs, like the nose on El Cap. There's a speed record, and that goes back. There's decades of history of people trying to set a speed record or fastest known time on that particular route. Same thing with things like Mount Rainier, Denali, Mount McKinley. But it's been fairly limited to these few objectives, I would say, like these real famous objectives. And now all of a sudden it's kind of become a thing, like to go out and try to set an FKT on a traverse or a climb or whatever. And that didn't really happen 10 years ago. And then I should say that there is, we're not going to have a lot of climbers listening to this, but the climbing community still pushes back in certain quarters pretty hard because they don't want climbing to become competitive. And that's fine. They don't have to practice that way. But there's a certain climbing, like all these sports, is growing exponentially. So there's more people practicing these different segments of the sport.
Yeah, that was my question. As you were mentioning that, the sport growing, can you speak to the size of the sport and awareness, say, in Europe versus North America over here? Who's leading the way, and is it much more popular there than here?
We're talking about
Skimo.
Skimo is much more popular in Europe, and it has a much deeper history. I participate in a few Skimo races every year. For example, the last one I did was the one over my kind of backyard race, which is Telluride, the Tellurando. Great little fun event put on by a really good local shop called Jagged Edge. And I think all told, what did we have? I think 45 participants, including teams, individuals, male, female. In a lot of cases, there weren't three people to fill the podiums, you know, at the little award ceremony. Whereas near, my wife is from Austria, and there's a Skimo event near her, right on the border with Austria and Italy. And we went and did that a few years ago. I can't remember the name of it. It's got a crazy Italian name. And it was like the 80th anniversary.
Wow.
And there was hundreds and hundreds of participants. It was like this huge mass start, all kinds of people, you know, young, old, you know, and at a dinky little ski area with like three lifts, you know, in the like way up in the corner of northeastern corner of Italy near Austria. And, you know, the only years they didn't run it were during the World Wars, right? So, way different perspective, way different timeline. It's definitely gaining traction, particularly in mountainous areas, obviously. And you kind of need a ski area that has a uphill policy, meaning they allow you to skin uphill during business hours on suitable terrain for training. Because if you're actually going to be competitive, you need to have a hard pack course that you can actually train on.
Yeah, I like the fact that the podium isn't filling. There's a chance for me to become a podium finisher.
Yeah, there you go. Better sign up.
I just have to complete it. That's all. Bring the lights out and wait for dawn. Go ahead, AJW.
Hey, Steve, I want to switch gears a little bit. I was interested in the component of the book on where you talk about training methodology and so forth. And one of the interesting things that happened in ultra running, I don't know, about 12 years ago, you know, prior to that, a lot of it was, you know, was mostly about the running, getting in the miles, big weeks and so forth. But around, I don't know, you know, 06, 07, 08, we kind of saw right before the boom of 2010, we saw guys just shifting gears and just going all after the vert. I mean, whether it was just run uphill, run downhill, repeat, run uphill, run downhill, repeat. And they were, you know, doing that, you know, running, you know, doing volume of 12, 15, 20,000 feet a week, you know, and then coming into relatively runnable 100 milers like Western States and really doing well. I mean, one of the best stories about that is Jeff Rose, who lived in Juneau, Alaska, and just started at sea level and ran up to 3,500 feet and ran back down and just did it day after day after day and ended up coming to Western States and setting the course record at the time. It seems as though, so here we are a decade later, and everybody in ultra running integrates a certain healthy dose of vertical into their running. When I think of your training program, and it looks, you know, integrating strength work into it, integrating a lot of climbing and descending, how do you, if you're working with a runner or if you're working with people who coach runners, how are you finding a way to balance that, you know, whether you're a mountain person who runs, which is certainly the way Killian describes himself, or a runner who climbs, which we have quite a few in our sport. How do you work to kind of blend those two worlds?
You know, I think it comes kind of down to what you're basically alluding to here at the end of your question, is that all training has to be individualized. There's no blanket recipe that works for everybody. It's going to depend on the goals, like you said. It's going to depend on the athlete's background, their strengths and weaknesses, so forth, and maybe even to a certain extent, just their morphology. Some people need a lot of strength. Some people don't. Some people come to the table already really strong. So, you know, these are all different things. But I think, you know, when we look at athletes from, I mean, that's the beauty of coaching, right? And I was coached as an athlete by Scott for very close to 10 years, 9.5 years. And I've also been coaching myself now for about 5 years, mostly mountaineers. However, it's really, the beauty of that partnership is that you have an outside perspective on your strengths and weaknesses that is usually more accurate than your own assessment. And they're able to gauge what you need better than you do yourself. And so that's, I mean, there's nothing surprising probably to anybody about that. I mean, that's a sort of part of human nature. But I think that as a coach, it's your just job to kind of blend that correctly, find that balance for that given for any given athlete, the right one for them.
Do you have any thoughts on, if you're self-coaching, and a lot of us do self-coach, how do you objectively look at your strength or your weakness? What do you think is a good tool for that?
I think the best tool is objective assessments of some kind, whatever you're trying to assess, whether it's, you know, with my athletes, for example, I mean, they're, like I said, they're mostly mountaineers, but like, for example, I've got a guy that who's been coaching for almost 4 years, and it's 4 years, and he lives in Hong Kong, and he's an airline pilot, and he climbs in Alaska and he climbs in the Himalaya. But we have these courses, these trails, these peaks that have trails on them, I guess. And we have now like a lot of data of him doing these particular workouts. We don't use them as training generally. We just use them as these sort of gauges, these checks. And that's one way to do it. I mean, obviously the gym gym strength is another super easy way to gauge gym strength. But there's all kinds of things you can come up with. I think that the biggest mistake, perhaps, that self-coached, inexperienced, I should add, self-coached athletes is they don't know what to assess. And they typically err on the side of, in my experience, assessing high intensity or kind of like their maximal output instead of assessing their ability to just go super long for, you know, without continuously, long and continuously.
If you and I were sitting at the airport waiting for our plane and our seats weren't together, so you couldn't extend the conversation too long. And I said, you know, Steve, I want to become a better uphill runner. What are three things do you think I should really think about doing and look at my own training? You're just going to throw off three bullet points. Where should I look?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the first thing I would say is to try to adapt a long view. Like, don't look at this in terms of a month or 4 months. Try to look at, you know, this in the view of even a lifetime, if you can muster that. But especially of a athletic career, or at least multi-year. The other thing I would think of I think athletes underestimate two things. The other 2 points I would say is never underestimate the power of consistency. Just getting out the door, you know, 6 days a week, roughly, you know, we all need a rest day here and there, whatever, if you use a 7 day week or an 8 day week or a 10 day week, doesn't matter. Get your life figured out so you can hit the workouts on a very regular basis. Consistency is incredibly powerful for what, you know, ultra running, uphill running. And then the last thing is to take your recovery seriously in terms of how you approach it. Be cognizant of how you sleep, nutrition, these things, all the things that you think would support recovery. That would be my over the aisle conversation.
Awesome. you mentioned 7 day training block or 10 day, and we're so used to just running things by the week. And I'm always interested in the 10 day block or something else. Cause we're so into seven because that's what the calendar says. Yeah. And the days of the week. So maybe you could just talk to us a little bit about what's the advantage of that 10-day? What would you do different if you had a 10-day versus a 7-day week for your athletes?
Yeah, some athletes I run on a longer cycle in terms of the frequency of their full rest day because they can handle it. Like they're pretty evolved athletes with pretty big bases who can handle a lot of volume. And that's when, like, for example, if you have a 7 day week and you have 1 day as a rest day and that leaves you six and you're doing one, say, high mileage day, long day, you know, some athletes eventually get to a point where they need another kind of high mileage day in there, but 6 days isn't enough. There's no way to space two long days within six. That makes sense. So then you can say, okay, well, let's move to eight or let's move to 10. And that gives us enough days in between these longer runs, for example, or hikes or skis or whatever they are. So there's, you know, I think that's a little bit of an esoteric, in my experience, it's a bit of an esoteric approach or technique, but it does come in handy with some of these people that just end up with these big bases and need to figure out a way to get the volume in.
Hey, Steve, following up on that, one of the hot topics in ultra running is longevity. And we have, especially
for us old people, right, Andy?
Yeah. But in the last decade, especially in ultra running, there've been some rather high profile sort of examples of people coming into the sport and burning out in a year, 18 months or 2 years. And one of the things I admire about you mountaineers is there's seem to be all these grizzled veterans, you know, hanging around, sitting around the fire, dispensing wisdom. They may not be doing the same gnarly stuff they did in their 30s and 40s, but it does seem as though you guys are onto something when it comes to sort of pacing your training and maybe maybe erring on the side of big long days at a relatively relaxed endurance pace rather than, you know, more, faster, better. What might you offer from the mountaineering space, you think, about, you know, training an athlete who does need to improve through, you know, maximal or sub-maximal workouts while also pacing themselves enough to, as you say, be in it for the long haul? Because when you look around the world of climbing, you tend to see a lot more old timers still hanging around than you do an ultra runner.
That's interesting. I had not personally made that observation, but if I reflect on it, I think I would have to agree that that seems to be true about the number of old timers. Yeah, it's interesting, you know, at the Scott and one of the athletes he coaches, an ultra runner by the name of Mike Foote, and another one named Luke Nelson, actually worked together on a longer form. I think it's like 5,000 word article that we posted on the website last fall about overtraining and ultra running, because it, you know, Mike and Luke were both concerned for various reasons. I think it was their way of like having a way of expressing their concern in a constructive way to the community, but also specifically to some certain people that they were watching sort of self-destruct through overtraining. I think that with climbing, like for example, when I go on an expedition, the expedition, the climb itself, the whole event often takes 2 months. Mm-hmm. So I think that provides us mountaineers with a little different time perspective. Like I've got to travel to Pakistan or Nepal or Tibet, then I've got to walk for a week before I even see the mountain, and then maybe walk a few more days to get to it, that I've got to establish a base camp where I can kind of store a bunch of food and fuel and get a cook in there and like set up or can kind of basically live for a month or so. And then because we're talking about going to, you know, 26, 27, 28,000 feet above sea level, like your body has to have a lot of time to adapt to that. And then that process takes a month. So all these things kind of, I think, create within our mindset quite a long view of things. I mean, the actual mm-hmm. climb only takes a few days to a week, but the process of the climb is much, much longer. And then we come back and, you know, you've been, you know, eating rice and lentils for 2 months and you're super depleted and you just need to lay on the beach for a couple of weeks, physically and mentally. So I think the beauty of running and the devil of running is that it is so accessible all the time. It's so easy to put your shoes on and go out the door.
Yeah.
So for people who have that type A mentality, like ultra runners tend to do, as well as high altitude mountaineer, they totally get it. But not a put down, it's a brotherhood and sisterhood. It's like, we just want to do it. We just want to do more. That's what we live for. We live to run, we live to climb. I think with climbing though, the logistics of it are such that it changes our perspective.
Do you think there's any contribution from the trail is harder, dirt's harder than snow? Do you think there's anything to...
Yeah, I'm sure there is.
You know, I was just thinking and remembering back, one of the great climbing books that I read was the best-selling book by Ed Viesters called No Shortcuts to the Top. And it kind of gave a little bit of a history of how he trained for these events. And he was an ultra runner. I don't know if he ever competed in any events or not, but he would go out, you know, he'd work construction. He'd go out and run for 20 miles after work, after being totally working construction all day. And I just remembered, okay, this guy's part of our tribe. He understands how to go out there. And that was an interesting part of it. But the question I had, that was just a comment.
Okay, that was the prelude.
The question I have is on strength training. You have a section in the book on mm-hmm. strength
yeah.
training and some really, really good information. And I want to have you comment on this. You said among similarly performing endurance athletes, the stronger one is most always going to win. So strength training.
Well, strength is, as you Well, if you think of, strength is very highly related to speed, right? So, I mean, it's just force. So that's what that sentence means, I believe. That's what that's alluding to.
Well, as you get into the book a little bit more, I think there's an interesting philosophy in there where we as ultra runners, we're not looking for speed, at least the mid and backpackers. We're not looking for speed. We're looking for
the ones up
long,
front, certainly are.
Slow, consistent finishes, right?
Yep.
And you get into the book here and you say, you know, you still need to do strength training, but strength training that's not going to develop big bulk. And I think that there's a fine line on doing that. You know, Don knows how to build bulk because he used to do that for a good portion of his life. In high school, that's all I wanted to do was build bulk for football. And I don't know whether I know a good way to do strength training and not produce bulk. Can you get into some of the tactics on how we can include strength training?
Yeah, I suspect that for you, personally, that has to do because with your high school history there,
mm-hmm.
your body knows, you know, you were doing that. So, I mean, that's where I mentioned morphology in the beginning, like how, you know, you look at a starting line at any of these ultras and you're going to see a bunch of different body types, right? Yeah. And there are people who need to put on muscle mass and there are people who need to strip muscle mass in terms of achieving their ultimate or their ideal performance. So there are certainly the good thing about strength training is it's so easily studied. It's been so highly studied that there's a lot that we can know pretty much for certain within a range, and the range being determined by the person's genetics and history. That's another thing where, you know, what we try to do is guide people through an assessment of what they need and where they are with their strength or their size of their muscles in relation to where they would like to be, and then walk them through figuring out how to design a program through that. Strength training is, you know, especially in the former Soviet Union, they did so many experiments that on this, and people with track and field backgrounds will recognize names like Firkoshensky and some of these guys that, you know, back in the behind the Iron Curtain were doing all kinds of crazy testing of different set and rep regimes on athletes of all types.
And I think that you bring out in the book too that it needs to be specific strength training exercises. So it's not like we need to go into the weight room and do a whole bunch of bench pressing. It'd be better for us to do some reverse lunges or one-footed squats or something like that. That's very specific to the sport that we're trying to get better at.
Yeah, there's a little joke. Maybe you have an ultra bunny, but we haven't. I mean, if a climber ever finds himself lying on his back on a bench pushing a weight, he's done something terribly, terribly wrong. The bench press has no bearing on climbing. Like, it has nothing to do with it. But there are lots of other exercises that you can do in a gym that would look something like climbing that would be related. And I would say that same thing, joke about the bench press is true for runners too. Yeah. I mean, there's no function in that exercise. Now, you could do a weighted plank or a weighted push-up where you're holding a plank position with, you know, extra, like some weights gently set on your back by a training partner and do push-ups. That's going to have all kinds of different benefits that are probably going to be more applicable to trail running or climbing than a bench press. But, you know, with all types of training, and I think this is pretty well understood, I'm sure you guys have talked about it before, is, you know, all of this is essentially periodized. So in the beginning, we're trying to use strength training to make people more injury proof. And so it's more the strength training is very, the exercises can be very general. We're just trying to get the muscles conditioned. We're trying to get the joints to be aligned correctly, trying to address imbalances all through the, you know, human body chain. So, and then as you progress, it becomes more and more specific, and the more, you know, not going to have people do walking lunges the first day of a training program because it's too specific, you know, and there's too much room for error. We need to start with really simple controlled exercises that are just making sure the knees are tracking correctly so we don't introduce injury early on, those kinds of things. But then we go into that extensively in the book. And we're big believers in that. It's been a big, let's say, I don't want to say battle, that's not the right word, but it's been a big theme of what we've been talking to the climbing and mountaineering community as well, because of strength training, because they don't, they have the same mentality. I don't want to do anything that might make me bigger, and training with weights in the gym is going to make me bigger. I was like, well, not necessarily. Let's find out who you are and how we can adjust your sets and reps and weights so that we make sure that doesn't happen. Because in any of these sports, what's in common is all of us have to carry our engine, and we don't want our engine to be very heavy, you know, so it's really important to stay light.
Hey, Steve, I feel like a fish swimming around inside the trail running fish bowl. And I'm getting a chance to now look into the other bowl, which you guys are in. What's your conversation about altitude training systems? Do you, the hypoxic or, you know, sleeping in the mask or training in a mask, do you guys use that? I know that we've dabbled in it over here and it's gaining some traction. I was wondering what it's like over there.
Yeah, it's still super controversial. So what we found, and I actually partnered with a woman who has been an expedition doctor on over 20 Everest expeditions. Wow. And we wrote a long form article on the website about this very subject as it pertains to what some people call pre-acclimatization, talking about extreme altitude. So they're talking about going to 25, 26,000 feet by pre-acclimating using a hypoxic tent type thing. A normal barrack hypoxic chamber of some type, right, where you don't change the pressure, you just change the relationship of the amount of oxygen in the air that the person, the athlete, is breathing. So, which is different than a real a room that changes pressure, like they right. also have in sports. That's a totally different mechanism, a totally different thing. But normal baric hypoxic training, this is how we come down on it. We don't want people to use it during late phases of important base training. So if you're going to go to Everest in April, typical start time for Everest season, you could be in that tent 8 weeks prior, but when you get it, by the time you get in that tent on February 1st, your training kind of has to be done, because the use of the tent impacts your recovery ability so severely that you can't train hard and be in the tent because you don't recover, because you're not getting enough oxygen, which, as we know, is the fuel and the key fuel for all things aerobic and physiological. So we need those oxygen molecules to get us through those recovery periods. So we will allow athletes that we coach to use it if they have a long enough time frame that we can get them all the way through a minimum of four. We tell them minimum, and I really prefer 6 months, but a minimum of 4 months of training before it's done, before February 1st. So then we can put them on a maintenance diet of training, and they can sleep in the tent and ramp themselves up to, low levels of oxygen in the tent during those final weeks of before their expeditions. People who do that and can do that, we have found to be able to acclimatize to real altitude, like going to Everest and going straight up to Camp One, which is I can't, depending on which route you're on, there's different routes, and Camp One on different routes is different altitudes, obviously. But that's getting between 18 and 20,000 feet, and they can do that within a few days of arriving, and that's pretty remarkable. People who we've had, and when we first started doing this, you know, a while ago, we hadn't learned this lesson yet, and we would let people try to train and use the tents, and they would actually do worse than everyone else because they were in such a hole physiologically. They were so tired, they were so under recovered, and they'd lost so much fitness through that whole kind of witch's cauldron of ingredients that they did worse than the people who hadn't used the tents.
Yeah, and that's what we found in our experiment of two, getting ready for a race. We found that when we were using it during our base miles to sleep with, sleep in the tent, you know, trying to do everything that we thought was right, we would get very fatigued and just couldn't recover from our workouts. And it was great to get on a stationary piece of equipment, put a mask on, and do a workout. We felt that was there was some value there, or at least some perceived value, not a deficit at least. But when we would then go home and try to get rest from all the work we did during the day, no way, sleeping in that tent was just like you were never rested.
Yeah. Scott and I actually back in the early 2000s experimented with that on me for high altitude mountaineering, and we just never found the right formula. I felt, and I think at that time, and it's a little different now, I think we attributed it to the duration of time between finishing the training in the tent and the sleeping in the tent and actually getting to high altitude. Now the logistics are much, much better. But 15 years ago, you'd basically be at sea level for 7 to 10 days, and it seemed to be all gone by the time I got to actual altitude. So people have been trying these things for a while. Scott and I also had the honor to speak at a conference that was specific to high altitude, but it was particularly interested in looking at military operators. It was an international conference. It was special forces from a bunch of U.S. forces and our allies. And there was doctors, there was other coaches. There was a bunch of people talking about this thing. And what works best is they put soldiers in an unpressurized plane and go up and fly them around at 20,000 feet.
And they can afford to do that.
Yeah. You know, the rest of us, not so much.
Not so much.
Hey, you know, you say high altitude. It'd be interesting to hear your definition of what is high altitude.
Yeah, I define it as 5,000 meters, which is about 18,000 feet.
Well, I guess there's reason for us to have these.
Yeah, and that is different. You know, I mean, I know, like, you know, and if you have Olympic or World Cup sports, I mean, the limit is even what, like 7,000 feet or something for a World Cup race, so or an Olympic race. So it's it varies a lot, but obviously, by 7,000 feet, your performance level is getting affected by the change in, you know, change in available oxygen due to pressure. So I live at almost 8,000 feet, so. Not ideal for training, actually, because it's hard to get the heart rate high enough for intensity.
Interesting. Hey, maybe a good time to mention, because we had Scott Johnson on before, and we alluded to earlier in this conversation that on your website, what is your website? I'm sorry.
Our website is uphilltraining.com.
Uphillathlete.com.
Sorry.
Uphillathlete.com has over 250 articles there that are free to gather and educate yourself and comb through some of these citations that you feel are important and useful to us. So, you know, we thank you for that and want to encourage, we'll put it in the show notes.
And it's a great resource, because a lot of times we get stuck in our fishbowl, like you were talking about. Uh-huh. Here's a great resource on uphillathlete.com, and also in the book, Training for the Uphill Athlete, that relates very, very well to what we're doing, and we can gain a lot of knowledge, additional knowledge from it.
I know how important cross training is to do something different with your body besides staying in that same rut. Really brings a lot of strength and freshness and keeps us going. I've got to think that for the athletes that have the seasons, you know, out here in California, our season is, you know, I don't know what our Christmas season and not Christmas. I don't know what our seasons are here because they're all similar. But living in an environment like Colorado, you have a chance to really switch your sports and use different systems within your body. I've got to think that's an advantage.
Yeah, I feel it is. I mean, and even within climbing, for example, you know, I'm much more focused on rock climbing in the summer, and I focus on ice climbing in the winter. And there, I think rock climbing is very, very tough on your fingers, particularly, and those tendons are small. And a lot of people get overuse injuries, and sometimes traumatic career ending overuse injuries if they blow out a key tendon and a key finger. But switching over to ice climbing every year, I feel like is one of the reasons I've never had a finger injury and have continued to be able to climb at a pretty high level. So I think it's the same why we see runners going skiing. And I think if you go to, especially the Skimo races, as a guy who grew up skiing, it's sometimes comical to me. I see these participants, they're super good on the uphill, but you get to the downhill, and they're like so slow. It's unbelievable. Like I just point them and it's no problem. You get runners that have never skied trying to do Skimo races. I think it's important for them to sometimes get a lesson or two before they launch in too hard.
That's good.
Hey Steve, in the book, and maybe we'll have to edit this out because I don't know anything about it. I was just flipping through the book and I saw the workout categories, Z1, Z2 through Z5. Can you give us a little more information on that? I've never heard workout categories. And
that's a reference to I'm sure it's in the text, but it's talking about the intensity, zone one, zone two, zone three. You know, there's obviously a lot of zone systems out there that are talking about, some people will use an 8-zone intensity system. Obviously cyclists just use power meters and they're totally different. One of the things that's similar with all the sports that we're talking about, whether it's mountaineering or trail running or ski mountaineering, is they all happen on uneven, unpredictable surfaces with variable amounts of, so sometimes they're sandy, sometimes they're rocky, sometimes they're hard, sometimes they're soft, sometimes they're steep, sometimes they're flat, sometimes they're off camber, sometimes they're straight, all these different things. And so, lacking the equivalent of a power meter in cycling, the best tool we have for, kind of modulating and tracking the intensity that we're putting out as athletes is still the good old heart rate monitor.
Yeah, there's a lot of consistencies between all sports, and they include that engine, and we train them much the same. As a close-up question for you here as we're wrapping up, I'm that annoying guy that you thought you lost
in the airport,
in that lobby, right? And you're three or four people ahead of me. and I'd have to ask you that the night before, because I see pictures of you running with Killian up and down some of these hills.
Yeah.
The night before that meetup, how was your sleep? What did you think?
I was nervous, yeah, for sure. But actually not really, because I know he doesn't expect me to keep up with him. Like I can't run with that guy. There's no way. But conversely, he probably can't climb with me. So, it's fine. And we were out there to, it's actually much better for me if we're on skis, because that is something I'm comfortable on. I've skied a lot in my life. I grew up, my sport when I was a kid was cross country ski racing. That was what I was into. So I've got that background, being on planks for a long time. But yeah, it's super nerve wracking running with Killian, but he's really, he's such a nice guy that, he would never say anything, but as soon as the rope comes out, things equalize. That the cover photo is one I took actually with an iPhone, after climbing this peak with Killian, and we were there, as I said, trying to do this ridge traverse that he wanted to do, and it had some pretty technical sections, but it was snowing a lot, and it's all just fresh snow, as you can see in the picture, it's totally white, and you can see the cloud level below, it's like still raining down there in the valley. But I remember commenting to Scott, like, I was really glad it was so snowy, because that let me keep up with Killian, because those kinds of like, it really became much more towards the mountaineering side than it was. If that had just been dry rock with the little goat path, I mean, he would have just been gone and would have had to wait for me. But because it was all snowing, you actually had to be pretty careful. It kind of helped me.
I can't believe that was taken with an iPhone.
Yeah, it looks like something Canon or Nikon or somebody would be proud to put out there.
And that again, was a total snapshot. That was complete luck.
And again, Don mentioned at the beginning, this book has a lot of good information. but it has a lot of good photos in there too. I mean, if you just want to peruse the photos as you're recovering or doing some stretching or something, I mean, it's a great book to look at.
Training for the FPL athlete. Yep. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, inspiration takes many forms, and as, you know, with, I know for climbers, it's I think that our sport is extremely photogenic. The mountains are obviously extremely beautiful, and we get to some pretty amazing places. And all that's true for mountain runners and ski mountaineers too. I mean, whether it's like up here in the San Juans in the summer, I mean, you know, from running the hard rock and being up here, I mean, it's gorgeous up there, and there's no reason you can't try to share that, communicate that through the images.
I always look way better with a very good background, and I'm as small as you can possibly see. If you have to squint to see, that's the best photo of me.
Yeah, that's your best. That's your best side.
That's my best side. Yep. Yep.
Training for the uphill athlete: a manual for mountain runners and ski mountaineers by Steve House, Scott Johnson, and Killian Jornet. We'd like to thank you for your time and your expertise and putting the many hours it takes to compile all this information into one spot. We really benefit from it, and I think it's a new look. It's a different look. It's not just another book. This is one to get and one to enjoy.
And it's good. It's cross reading is what I like to cross learning, taking things from another sport. The one thing that I do like about it, excuse me, is, you know, Killian does write in this book, so he has his little corners where he makes comments about what the subject is that we're talking about in the book. So it's a really, really good read. It's a reference material.
Where's the best place? Go ahead.
I would say that Killian was actually involved in a lot of this, though, because of his time constraints, and he was really upfront in the beginning of this, a lot of it happened on Skype, you know, just through conversations. He would be wherever he was racing or training, and Scott or I would call him and talk through his perspective on certain things so that that's integrated throughout. But there were certainly things that came out of those conversations where we really just wanted it to come right from him, because he is obviously kind of the authority. And he, you know, I don't think most people know that, but not only does Killian self-coach, but he studied exercise to his physiology. Like, that's what he went to college for, university for. He has a degree in it. And so he has a very good understanding of training. And that's one of the big reasons I think he's been able to be so successful. He worked with coaches starting from 11, you know, I mean, I think that in that world, people don't, I mean, it's same in climbing. People only see these ultimate accomplishments that just seem kind of impossible. But when you dive into his history and realize that he's been a focused athlete since he was 11, and that he did all these crazy training experiments on himself with fasting for days on end and training and had coaches and studied the stuff. And then it starts to make sense that why he's been so successful. And we tried.
I would also add, as I've had my conversations with Killian over the years, another piece that I think is really, really inspiring is he has a passion for the history of ultra running. Absolutely. And mountaineering. And he realizes, as great an athlete as he is, he realizes that he's part of a continuum. And whether it's those early alpinists on Everest, or the early runners who did the Bob Graham round, or any of the other classic running routes, he really, really does his homework. And I think there's a lot of people in the community that can learn from that. There's so many people coming into both of our sports with kind of a Johnny come lately attitude, and I find it refreshing that Killian, at still a relatively young age, and really understands going deep back into, you know, the 30s and 40s and 50s into the history. And I for one appreciate that, and always like an opportunity every year at Hard Rock to chat a little bit about that. So that's along with his deep understanding of exercise phys. I mean, while he's gifted and naturally talented, which, you know, he is, his actual success has not come by accident.
No, success is rarely accidental.
And
I would also say I appreciate your mentioning the website and the book and those resources. And a little bit about my history that feeds into that is that I had a really bad, basically high level career ending and almost fatal accident nine years ago. And everything in my life since then has been very purpose driven, because when I was laying on a ledge in the Canadian Rockies thinking I was going to die that day, I really had the thought that, you know what, if I die today, I'm pretty happy with the climbing I did, but I'm disappointed that I didn't do more for my community. Wow. And so everything that has come since then, and Scott was there as my coach and one of my best friends. And, you know, I mean, you become so attached and close to your coach because it's the person you talk to more than anyone, you know. And he, when I was recovering, and we talked about writing a training book for alpinism, but we seriously thought we'd write it up and put it together 1,000 copies and staple them and hand them to our friends. That was seriously what we expected. And we were kind of surprised. I have a long, Patagonia has been my sponsor as a climber for, it'll be 20 years in June. And, you know, they had just started doing books. And then I mentioned this to someone anyway, and we were surprised somebody actually wanted to publish it. And so this is just a kind of a continuation of that purpose. And I love what I love the most about this is that it's all been so organic. We thought we were going to write a pamphlet that was going to be stapled together and handed out for free. We ended up writing a book that sold over 50,000 copies. I mean, alpinism is a, mountaineering is a small sport. And then through Killian, he kind of inspired us and motivated us to get it together to share some of this. And there's so much crossover between mountaineering and climbing and mountain running and skimo. I mean, we're all doing all of each other's, quote unquote, each other's sports all the time. And just to see this whole community kind of grow in that way has been super inspiring and incredibly rewarding.
Wow, that's a wonderful tribute.
Thank you for your focus and in sharing your knowledge, because we appreciate that. We're a community that likes to share, and so thank you. We really recognize that. It just made us a little closer together. The fishbowl glasses thinned just a little bit. We may be able to break through here soon.
Kind of like the dual screen monitor, right? You can kind of. Well, Steve House, we appreciate your time. We appreciate your knowledge, and we look forward to future endeavors that you extend yourself to and share that with us. So thank you for joining us today on the podcast.
Yeah, more than happy to do it. Thanks for all being here and asking some great questions. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Andy.
Now go out and run.
Mas.
Mas.